From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's been one tough week for Maine's Governor Paul LePage.
When I was called a racist, I just lost it. And it's no excuse. It's unacceptable. It is totally my fault.
What's next for the governor? We'll ask our Week in Review panel. Also today, a Milford family whose son was killed by a drunk driver in the country illegally, and why they're standing beside Donald Trump.
We have the laws in place to deport people who break our laws. I believe he will enforce our current laws.
Plus, when we think of public art in Boston, what are we missing?
We do have some great bronze, dead, and white guys downtown. But coming here to Roxbury, there's amazing art all over our communities.
Two local public artists join us to explain. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, which means time for the Week in Review, starting with the rough week for Maine's Governor Paul LePage. Yesterday, Democratic and Republican state leaders met in Augusta to talk about LePage's voicemail tirade against a legislator. They're continuing those discussions today, but haven't yet come to an agreement about what to do with LePage. Here's Maine House Republican Minority Leader Ken Fredette.
I think this governor is well aware that he's on a very short leash, that people are watching. Republicans are watching. Democrats are watching. The nation is watching. And he needs to continue to be respectful, to understand that he has said something that's horrific and that he needs to be accountable for that.
Fredette's referencing that expletive-laden voicemail that LePage left for a Democratic state rep last week.
I want to talk to you. I want you to prove that I'm a racist. I've spent my life helping black people, and you little son of a socialist.
Well, then, as the backlash grew over his remarks, this week, LePage said this on a Maine radio station.
And it's really one thing to have one party behind you. It's another thing not to have any party behind you. So we have to move Maine forward, whether it's me or somebody else.
That set heads spinning, but later the same day, the governor tweeted about premature rumors of his political demise. So, we'll dig into the LePage story and the rest of the week's news with our Week in Review panel. Joining us in the studio is Tiziana Deering. She's an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Boston College and also a member of WBUR's Community Advisory Board. Tiziana, good to see you.
Hello.
Also with us, the Boston Globe op-ed columnist. Sorry, Dante. You've been here so frequently, I should be able to do this. Boston Globe op-ed columnist Dante Ramos. It's great to see you as well.
Great to be here.
I keep saying with a name like Meghna Chakrabarty, I shouldn't be mispronouncing anything on the show, and yet I do. So first of all, let's get your reaction to the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, the spinning, the unspinning, the waffling. I don't know what you call it with Maine Governor Paul LePage. Dante, let's start with you.
I almost can't believe I'm saying this. I think Paul LePage is revealing himself as the less varnished and more erratic version of Donald Trump.
He did claim that he was Trump before Trump was, right?
I mean, and I think that that's not a trivial thing for him to say. And it's not just in terms of the politics. I mean, his background is not a conventional government background. And you know, I think there can be benefits to having non-traditional candidates for office. But in the case of LePage and in the case of Trump, too, you have people who were somewhat loosely attached to the idea of governing and to the kind of art that it takes to actually make that happen. And there's this almost, I don't want to call it an authoritarian cult of the, you know, the businessman who comes into office. But, you know, I think that there's a frustration for people in that position because they think that they can just order things and it'll happen. And when that doesn't happen, it just becomes something that makes them feel in over their heads.
Tiziana?
Well, I want to start with his tweet about his, you know, the rumors of his political demise are exaggerated. Dude, this is demise, right? He may not be resigning from office and he may not be thrown out of office, but you can't have a week like this and not have some demise going on. He is a weakened chief executive of a state who has shaken the faith of his party. There's some demise going on here. And, you know, the Trump theme, I think, is a really important one because a little bit I find myself thinking, if people are wondering what this temperament question, whether it's real or whether it's sort of been made up for Trump. It's real. It's happening in Maine. And if you wonder what it's going to look like after someone like Trump is elected, we're playing that out in this kind of bizarre morality play in Maine right now.
It's an interesting point because, I mean, you know, some people have the discipline to stay on script, and then maybe that version of themselves continues on when they're off script. But I guess you're implying that you don't see that discipline in either Paul LePage or Donald Trump.
No, and it's a discipline that is both possible and necessary. And one of the things that, you know, the juxtaposition of what's happening with LePage and Trump is doing is really raising the question of a more sophisticated understanding of what it takes to lead. And we, when we make choices as voters, are choosing the whole package of leadership, and it is raising interesting issues about what it takes to be an effective leader every single day.
I think it does, you know, if Shakespeare were alive today, you know, we'd be reading Paul the First, the tragedy or something. You know, the idea that there is an essential personality that people bring to the things that they do is something that is obvious in the Trump campaign and obvious in the LePage situation as well. You know, you hear LePage's fellow Republicans essentially asking for him to be a different kind of person. And, you know, I think the average person on the street knows, like, that's just not even possible. And yet there's a certain amount of political expectation that, oh, yeah, you can just change and be this conventional, normal, non-voicemail leaving governor.
Yeah, you know, but there are many people who don't want him to be any different, though. I mean, he's not a governor with zero support in his state. Politically, amongst party leaders on both sides in Maine, obviously, there's a problem, Tiziana, as you pointed out. But I mean, the very fact that, and I return to Donald Trump here, that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee tells us that the kind of unedited, unvarnished, at times, you know, if need to be expletive laden, as Paul LePage was, that style of leadership or politician is on the ascendance, maybe?
Well, so it's interesting because everybody loves that person who blurts out what they wish they could say sometimes, even against the better angels of our nature, right? The really bad things we wish we could blurt out. Sometimes it's very gratifying to have someone else do it. And I think hopefully the N of two of Paul LePage and Donald Trump, although I would actually lump Chris Christie in this same wheelhouse, right, doesn't necessarily indicate that it's on the ascendancy versus a trend that's happening smaller. At the same time, that doesn't mean it's right. That doesn't mean that just because people like it and they're willing to vote for it, that they're going to be pleased with the results of executive leadership and getting things done that then happen afterward. And we might wind up with a really painful voting hangover, you know, in lots of different cases if we're going to continue to put people who don't have that last piece locked in.
Dante, on Wednesday, Paul LePage told reporters that he will no longer talk to the press, quote, ever again, and that he's, quote, tired of being caught in the gotcha moments. I'm not sure what to make of that.
I'm not either. I think LePage has done quite a good job of putting himself in the gotcha moments. And another comparison you could make to Donald Trump is that he's mad at the press essentially for faithfully recording the things that he actually said. And, you know, the things that he said were kind of impolitic and hurt him politically. And it's not the press's fault that he actually said those things. It's not as though he's been misquoted.
Well, plus, that voicemail was not in the press. He left that on a guy's voicemail and then said give this to the press.
Yeah.
Lest people not know I'm coming after you.
Exactly.
And he ended his voicemail with a thank you, too, which I always have to know. But okay, so actually, this is a great opening for us to sort of kind of reacquaint ourselves with some of the context of how LePage got to this point this week, because he has been saying repeatedly things about the opioid crisis in Maine and his claims on who's trafficking opioids into Maine and his claim that he believes that they are all African-American and Latinos bringing the drugs into Maine, comments which he has actually stood by, and he did so even this week in Boston because he was here for the Conference of New England Governors and Eastern Canadian Premiers on Monday, and he said this.
The heroin fentanyl arrests are not white people. They're Hispanic and they're black and they're from Lowell and Lawrence, Massachusetts, Waterbury, Connecticut, the Bronx and Brooklyn. So I didn't make up the rules. That's how it turns out.
Well, guess who that caught the attention of? The mayors of Lawrence and Lowell, Massachusetts. They both spoke on WBZ-TV. And in this clip, you'll hear from Lowell Mayor Ed Kennedy and then Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera.
I was a little bit outraged and surprised. I think it just shows that the governor of Maine is ill-informed about the issue completely.
You know, we're the New England states. We should be working together. We shouldn't be trying to figure out who to point fingers at. And at the end of the day, really, it is a national problem.
So this is exactly something that I have been struggling with for 2 weeks now. Everybody in New England cares about the opioid crisis. I mean, I don't understand why Paul LePage felt the need to bring in this incendiary racial claim. Do you guys have any thoughts about why, Tiziana?
Yeah, I do, actually, because I was thinking about this, right? I think, in part, listen, the opioid crisis is a serious, serious issue when we need serious people with serious approaches to help solve it. And if you don't have those things, one strategy that politicians have used since the dawn of politicians is scapegoating. And when it's not Maine's fault, because it's somebody else's fault, and that somebody else is sending their bad people into my state, it's a substitute for serious understanding of the data, serious understanding of the evidence, and serious public policy development.
Dante?
I agree 100%. I think that the opioid crisis in every state where it exists, you know, represents a health problem. It represents a rip in the social contract. It reflects the kind of negativity and lack of hopefulness that a lot of people are feeling out there. And it's something that really goes to kind of it's something that, you know, deep in the soul of Maine and all of the other states that are grappling with this, that we really need to be thinking about. And it's just easier to blame a demographic other for something rather than engage in the kind of introspection and, you know, tough, you know, case by case work to solve the problem.
Right. Well, you know, in the interest of facts and fact checking, the FBI Criminal Justice Information Service has some numbers from 2014. And in that year, 1,211 people were arrested for selling or making drugs in Maine. And of those, 14% were black. And so, you know, again, obviously a very different set of numbers than Paul LePage claims to be getting his information from. But something tells me we're going to keep talking about the governor for maybe a couple more weeks, if not even more than that. So let's switch gears here and give us some time to talk about another major story in this week's news, and that it comes out of New Hampshire and a development in the prep school rape case at St. Paul's. Now, the victim of that case actually went public this week. She's Chessie Prout, and she told NBC's Today Show that she still struggles sometimes with what happened to her when she was a freshman, but that she's no longer afraid and wants to be a voice for others.
Even when I get my panic attacks and I lock myself in my closet because I don't want my little sister to see me like that, and she comes into my room sometimes and she'll come into my closet when I'm rocking on the floor and punching my legs trying to get myself to calm down. And she'll try to give me the biggest hug and she'll say, Chessie, you're okay, Chessie, you're okay. And I just can't imagine how scary it is for other people to have to do this alone. And I don't want anybody else to be alone anymore. I don't.
Well, her identity was kept secret during the trial last year. Tiziana, what do you make of her decision to speak publicly?
You know, I've done a lot of work over the last few years thinking about the power of your story. What it means, how intimate it is to share your story, and what a gift it is to share your story with someone else. And that was the first thing that struck me about her decision and her interview, is that after suffering from this violent intimate act, she found the strength to share that story as a gift, which is, I think, what she said it was intended to be, but I think it's what it is, too, to others who might be feeling isolated or victimized and can just hear one more story of survival and of moving forward. I'm sure lots will be said about this, but I think the gift of sharing that kind of story should be held as important and in the center of this discussion going forward. Dante?
I think if you look at the coverage of these types of cases over the years, you'll look back and you'll see that there has been a tendency to be very protective of the victims. And given the history of what's involved, I think we all understand that. That said, I think it's laudable and maybe, you know, very helpful for lots of other victims. If Chessie Prout is out there, it kind of dispels the idea that if you were a victim of sexual violence that you need to be hiding in the shadows. You know, we wouldn't expect someone who's been the victim of a burglary or the victim of some other, you know, a car accident or some other type of crime to sit there quietly and suffer through their experience on their own. And to the extent that this case shows young women that that there's no shame in what happened to her, I think it's positive. And I guess it should probably make a lot of us, you know, rethink, you know, the tendency to assume that victims, should just always remain anonymous.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting because just as to remind folks of Prout's fellow student Owen LaBrie was convicted on 3 counts of misdemeanor sexual assault last year. He's appealing those convictions. And meanwhile, Chessie Prout's family filed a civil suit against St. Paul's School earlier this summer, saying the boarding school failed to protect the students from this type of behavior because the assault happened in the context of a school tradition called, it had a name, the Senior Salute, where students reportedly involved themselves in sorts of, quote, sexual conquest before graduation. Now, St. Paul's made a statement issued to NBC News that said, "We categorically deny there ever existed at the school a culture or tradition of sexual assault." Now, it's interesting because it depends on how you interpret what the tradition of the Senior Salute was. But it challenges me to fully believe that administrators at a school with a close, intimate community, like a well-respected boarding school like this, wouldn't have some indication that maybe there was a tradition going on that could possibly lead to trouble or had led to trouble in the past, Itiana.
A, I find it implausible. B, especially, it's a boarding school full of teenagers. So one would expect that there would be a very active management of the sexual culture of that environment, let alone we deny. If there was a name for it, it was part of the culture and it was happening. And if you run the mental exercise of what would have happened if at every level of that institution, the mantra had been no sex in high school, no sex in high school, would you see a senior salute emerging and an administration who says we categorically deny it while alumni are saying, yep, that's what happens? So it's just, again, from a sort of leadership perspective, it's very hard for that to be a plausible claim. Now, I wasn't there. I get it. But it's hard for that to be a plausible claim.
Well, the St. Paul statement to NBC News continues. It says, however, there's no denying the survivors' experience caused us to look anew at the culture and environment. This fresh look has brought about positive changes at the school. Dante?
I think just going back to something that really both of you had said, in these very small, close-knit academic environments, I think that cuts both ways because you can, you know, it means that the adults can be more involved in and more aware of what's going on in the kids' lives intellectually, educationally, and otherwise. It also means that some of these environments turn into these little weird monocultures that are isolated from the outside world. And if you accept that the senior salute is a thing that happens at this school and everybody knows kind of what it was, even if people don't really know exactly what the contours of it are, you know, everyone's sort of ambiently aware of it. And the reaction that you would want people to have, which is like, wait a minute, this really shouldn't be something that's a custom that we celebrate. You know, there are no outsiders looking at this with fresh eyes. Everyone's deeply immersed in it to the point that it takes on a certain level of normalcy.
Yeah. I want to go back to a moment to the fact that Chessie Proud, I mean, we can say her name now because she has publicly spoken, but during the trial last year, her identity was withheld and wasn't reported in the press. And I wanted to ask you, remind everyone about that, because I did want to ask you guys about a story that was reported this week in the Globe about another case in New Hampshire as well, which actually could have an effect on rape shield laws. This one is actually a horrible, gruesome murder that happened. The victim was strangled and then raped. And this happened back. A conviction came across in 2014. The convicted person is appealing his case, and in part of the appeal, and this is going to be argued in front of the New Hampshire State Supreme Court. His defense attorneys are making the request that the victim's sexual history be unsealed. Now, obviously, the case is going to be heard before the New Hampshire Supreme Court later this month. But a lot of sexual assault victims' advocates around the country are looking at New Hampshire now and feeling a little concerned that 40 years of rape shield laws and traditions of keeping people's identities and own sexual histories private during these trials may be at risk. And Tiziana, I was wondering what your thought is on that.
They should be deeply concerned. I mean, what that begins to imply and what gets implied then can become believed and then becomes the basis for future public policy. And what that begins to imply is a rolling back of our real evidence-based understanding that rape is not about the victim's sexual history. It's about an act committed in the moment by the perpetrator. And to conflate those things when people in that field have worked for decades to unconflate them. There's probably a real word for that, but I don't know it.
Deconflate.
Thank you. Is that a real word?
No.
Deconflate those things. It is now. Really should be deeply, deeply concerning to victims' advocates, I think, everywhere.
It is a little bit ironic. I think one of the reasons why someone like Chessie Proud would feel comfortable coming forward is precisely because of that deconflation that has happened over the years. And people realize, okay, that's not something that Chessie Proud did. And this isn't, you know, that she's not tainted by this. She's not, you know, this is not a reflection on her. This, you know, the case that you're describing, Magna, seems to cut in the other direction.
All right. Well, it's always kind of tough to make the turn from these very serious, heavy topics that we make to our hubbubs, which is, of course, those stories that maybe were a little lighter, but still deserve a little time on the radio. I like to do them, though, because it is Friday afternoon. We're heading into a long weekend, so I want to put a smile on everyone's faces rather than talking about the doom and gloom that does seem to surround us at times. So, Tiziana, let's hear your hubbub.
All right. So it's been a very dry summer. And the summer isn't the only thing that's been dry, because if you're a college football fan, you've been missing a reason to wet your whistle with whatever and eat a lot of barbecue and hot dogs for as long as 9 months. But the drought of college football is over. It is College Football Saturday tomorrow. The football season is starting, and I think students and alumni are going to celebrate off the back of pickup trucks everywhere. The football powerhouses of MIT and Worcester Polytechnic square off on the gridiron tonight at 7 o'clock. And then this weekend, Boston College is preparing to rumble in the moors of Ireland against the obvious opponent, Georgia Tech, because that makes a lot
They're
of sense.
They're playing in Ireland?
Against Georgia Tech.
Okay.
And the likes of Harvard and Dartmouth are demurring for another week in order to let students to pretend for one weekend that some homework is going to happen. But the drought is over. It is college football time.
Hooray. Dante, your hubbub?
Well, speaking of wetness, the last few weeks here in Massachusetts have been noteworthy for a spectacular series of marine life sightings off of Cape Cod. Last week, you may have seen the viral video of orcas 12 miles off of Chatham. There was also an 8-foot manatee that made its way up the coast from Florida and was spotted off of the coast also of Chatham. The seal population all around the Outer Cape has rebounded, so you can see them literally everywhere. Not coincidentally, great white sharks have closed beaches in Provincetown and Truro because they show up a little too close to shore. There's also another recent video of a shark devouring a seal also off the coast of Provincetown. That one was a little bit too real for my taste. It's like a snuff film about seals. But it's also a reminder that marine life, it's not just a cute decoration for our beach time. They were there before we were. Glad to see them back.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a success for conservation efforts in a way. I was wondering whether or not the manatee should, if it's not such a good thing that the manatee made it this far north, given that, I don't know, the water shouldn't be so warm for a manatee.
Maybe the sharks will take care of that.
Oh, no. But you're right. That the seal video was
sorry, that was dark.
They're the mermaids.
It was dark.
Yeah, okay, poor manatee. Okay, swim back to Florida before it's too late. All right, so my hubbub has to do with the fact that, you know, we've got the digital information boards on many T stations now. The question is, do they provide you with information that's actually useful to you as an MBTA rider? Frequently, they don't. So that led two loyal MBTA riders to launch an online excuse generator that spits out made-up excuses for MBTA delays. One of them, Todd Ching, he said, you know, sometimes you'll see an excuse like signal problems at downtown crossing, but what does that mean? So the MBTA excuses generator, which I'm pulling it up right here, will do things like, okay, Green Line, minor delays due to a lack of interest in maintaining this pointless charade at Leechmere. We hope you enjoy waiting for an hour for three buses at one. Oh my God. I'm laughing because that has actually happened to me multiple times. Okay, let me do this again. Orange Line, moderate residual delays due to an earlier like an earlier horror at Ruggles. We are pretty sure this makes us a world-class city. The MBTA excuse generator. Look at it. Look for it when you're stuck on a red line train between, you know, Porter or Central and Harvard.
I'm waiting for an excuse to come up that a shark ate a manatee.
We'll give you another one. Blue Line, minor residual delays due to an earlier hometown bro-down at Suffolk Downs. We suggest continuing to stare blankly into the middle distance while you wait. Well, that's enough for the week in review. Tiziana Deering, associate professor in the School of Social Work at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Community Advisory Board. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks very much.
And Dante Ramos, Boston Globe op-ed columnist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Near the end of his immigration speech on Wednesday, Donald Trump invited a group of people onto the stage with him. They were family members of 10 people killed by immigrants who were in the country illegally.
I'm going to ask all of the angel moms to come join me on the stage right now. These are amazing women.
The group was mostly women, but not all, and they assembled behind the candidate, and Trump invited them to speak. Two of them, Maureen and Mike Maloney, are from Milford, Massachusetts.
My name is Maureen Maloney, and our son, Matthew Denise, was 23 years old when he was dragged a quarter of a mile to his death by an illegal alien, while horrified witnesses were banging on the truck trying to stop him.
If Donald Trump were president in 2011, our son Matthew Denise and other Americans would be alive today.
Well, earlier today, we spoke with Maureen and Mike Maloney at their home in Milford. And we talked about why they support Donald Trump and why they want to bring back the Secure Communities Initiative. That's a federal-state partnership where local law enforcement would be empowered to check the immigration status of anyone they arrest. But first, Maureen talked to us about her son.
You know, Matthew was a very outgoing, friendly man. Everybody in town knew him. He was loved by everybody. He had just graduated college in May of 2011, and he was killed in August.
Yeah, I see that he, when he graduated from Milford High School in 2006, he graduated with honors and was awarded the most dependable award from his classmates.
All his friends knew that if they had been out and they had drank, you know, they could call Matthew any time. And many times he went out and, you know, drove his friends home after they had been out and had drank too much.
So tell us what happened on August 20th, 2011.
So Matthew was in a residential area about 2 miles from our home, and he had the right of way. An illegal alien driving a pickup truck went through a stop sign. Matthew flew over the truck and landed on the windshield and then rolled off.
witnesses saw Matthew getting up out of the road, and the medical examiner testified in court that Matthew survived that impact with just abrasions and scratches. Then the driver of the truck fled the scene, and when he did, he ran over Matthew, and Matthew became lodged in the wheel well of the truck, and he was dragged a quarter of a mile to his death.
I can only imagine how much your life changed at that moment.
Absolutely.
The driver was intoxicated at the time.
He was drunk, yes. And he had his 5-year-old son in the truck with him, and yeah.
That person, that driver, Nicholas Guaman, I mean, had he had a previous criminal record in the United States?
He did have a criminal record. He had been charged with assault and battery on a police officer. He assaulted a fireman. He had a criminal record, a couple pages long.
Now, he was never convicted. He never served jail time for those previous crimes. He was just given probation. And some folks point out that that was the problem, that if he had been convicted, that maybe he would have been deported, so that there were some just basic issues with the criminal justice system as it is.
We have the laws in place to deport people who break our laws. You know, that's why we're supporting Donald Trump, because I believe he will enforce our current laws.
Mm. Now, if I may ask, when did you first meet Donald Trump?
Last August.
Mm-hmm. And what did he tell you when you told him about your family's and Matthew's story?
You know, he gave me a very sincere, warm hug, and I recognized the pain in his eyes that you see in any parent's eyes when they hear our story. So he said he will build the wall, and he will enforce our laws, and he's sorry that he can't do anything to bring Matthew back, but he will do everything he can to prevent further Americans and those here legally from being killed.
Hmm. Is the way that he has sometimes talked about immigration, has that concerned you? Because it's concerned a lot of other folks. You know, people saying that he is inciting xenophobia or racism. Have you had those concerns?
I haven't had those concerns. He is not a racist. I think those are just tags that people are using because they're afraid of his success and maybe afraid of him coming into political power and making changes that, you know, will impact a lot of maybe career politicians or others. I really believe he will be a very fair and just man.
Hmm. I mean, one of the reasons why I ask is because when it comes to immigration and secure communities, back in 2011, Governor Deval Patrick then, one of the reasons why he said he didn't sign the Massachusetts Secure Communities Memorandum was that he was concerned it could lead to racial profiling and even, you know, perhaps keeping many legal immigrants from reporting crimes.
Well, I think there's a big stigma with the word immigrant. Immigrant does not apply to just Latinos and Hispanics. I don't think it'll lead to profiling. I just feel that when you're pulled over and the police run a background check on you, it should touch all the databases, not only of the Homeland Security, but also internationally, so that immediately we can tell if that person is wanted anywhere in the world, not just in the United States. So as far as the secure communities promoting racial profile, I just think that's, again, another excuse, you know, to avoid the subject and the problems we're facing right now with our current, really the lack of enforcement of immigration laws.
Well, when you were on stage with Donald Trump this week, just a couple of days ago, what was that like?
It was sad and it was empowering because standing next to Mr. Trump and, you know, the other people in this campaign, is they realize the problem and they embrace it, and they embrace the fact that this is a big issue that really, up until Mr. Trump began his campaign, has been hidden and not brought to the attention of the public.
You know, Magda, I just want to point out one thing. First of all, our politicians are elected to serve us. You know, they're public servants. We've all elected and put them in the positions that they're in. And all deaths by illegal aliens are preventable because almost all of these people have come in contact with law enforcement at some point. And just being in the country is illegal. Working in the country and not paying taxes is illegal. So these people are breaking multiple laws just to survive in this country. And that does not include the ones that go on to commit violent crimes. So that's what people have to realize. If these people were deported with their first contact with law enforcement or Border Patrol, our children would be alive. Matthew would be alive. All these deaths are preventable. And that's the saddest part, is we do have the technology to enforce these laws, and they're just not being enforced.
Hmm. What made you decide that you wanted to speak out so publicly and be on that stage with Mr. Trump in Phoenix?
Well, I mean, we've been speaking out publicly for 5 years. It's just Donald Trump has given us a national platform. But it's twofold. I don't want Matthew's death to be in vain, and I don't want any other family members to suffer the pain and loss that we're suffering. You know, Matthew had dreams too, and his dreams were destroyed that day, August 11th, 2011. So Americans have dreams too.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to add on that. I think it's time to really put U.S. citizens, Americans first.
And I'm very in favor of immigrations, legal immigration. I don't know that we've ever spoke publicly about this before, but Mike was not born a U.S. citizen. My husband Mike was born in Germany. Mike was born here at 2 years old. So we are very in favor of legal immigration. It's just that you need to follow our laws. And if you want to come to the U.S., you need to follow the laws and assimilate. Follow our laws.
And by the way, I served in the military for 4 years, and I still had to go for my my naturalization. And I had to follow a process. I had to, you know, the same process that people come here to become legal U.S. Citizens. So even though I served 4 years in the U.S. Army, I had to go through the process.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious then what both of you think about this, because when the parents of Humayun Khan, Captain Khan, when his parents spoke at the Democratic National Convention, a lot of people heavily criticized them because they believed that they exploited their son's memory by speaking at the Democratic Convention. Did that concern worry you at all when you spoke alongside Mr. Trump in Phoenix?
You know, I'm probably not unbiased when it comes to the Khan family because we have the common thread that we both have lost our sons. However, if they spoke at the DNC and were coming from their heart, you know, that's all they can do. I took issue with how they attacked Donald Trump afterwards. I also don't agree with how Donald Trump handled the situation. You know, every family grieves differently, and so I don't think families can be judged based on the fact that they're speaking out and trying to make a difference versus those that are not speaking out and are just trying to move on with their lives as best they can. All our lives are shattered when we lose a child, and your life will never be the same again. And there really is no moving on. It's really just a matter of learning how to live without your child. So no grieving family should ever be judged on how they're dealing with their grief. So just have compassion for grieving families.
Yeah.
I want our laws enforced. I want to prevent others from being killed by illegal aliens. I was very proud to be there with Donald Trump, and I am supporting Donald Trump. But if Hillary Clinton invited me to speak at one of her rallies, I would be there 100%, even though I do not support anything with her. But just to get my message out, I would be there.
Well, Maureen and Mike Maloney of Milford, their son Matthew Denise was killed in 2011 by an unlicensed drunk driver who was in the country illegally. Maureen and Mike, thank you so much, so very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you go to our website right now, WBUR.org, and click on The Artery, you'll find a special list, the 50 best works of public art in Boston, ranked by WBUR arts reporter Greg Cook. We met Greg yesterday at a mural that came in at number 21.
We're in Roxbury on Warren Street at the corner of Clifford Street, near the McDonald's, and there's the Roxbury YMCA is a few blocks that way. That's also where the Caribbean Carnival Parade started last weekend.
Yeah. And we're standing in front of this magnificent, 100 feet long mural?
Yeah.
With a portrait of Nelson Mandela right in the middle of it. And on either side it says Roxbury Love. Where did this rank on your list of 50 best works of public art in Boston?
I put it at 21.
At 21. Okay.
Yes.
And why did this one even make the list?
I think it's an amazing mural. It's it's really striking, its scale and what it says, but it's also what it says about Boston. The two artists there, Richard Gomez, who goes by Deem 5, and Thomas Burns, who goes by Quest, they painted it 2 years ago, and they said, in part, it's a statement of pride in Black Boston. It's also a statement to Black Boston. Gomez tells me, he says, it's a message to the community to think before they act, to love instead of hate. But then it's also this really interesting connection of Boston and Mandela and what that means to the city. Boston and Massachusetts was one of the early supporters of the anti-apartheid movement, so they also were referencing that. And he came here in 1990, right after he was freed from 27 years in prison,
to
thank Boston and then to begin his successful campaign run to become president. It's also, there's this really interesting thing in 1986, Roxbury made an attempt to secede from Boston because people felt they weren't, African Americans in Boston felt they were sort of being neglected by the city. And so there was a ballot measure to secede, and if they didn't end up winning, and it became national news, this whole effort, but if they seceded, the name they wanted to call themselves was going to be Mandela.
So what is it, do you think, that it is about murals that makes them such effective or evocative forms of public art?
They're cheaper and faster to put up, and so you see these murals springing up all over the city, and it's different from downtown is all this bronze forever things, and that's partly the frustration people have of that they're so expensive and they take so long. The murals, you can put them up quickly, you can have an idea and get it done within a year or within a few months, or if you don't have permission, within a day, or something like that. So
right.
One of the things with this list is to try to look beyond downtown to sort of find public art that's not just the bronze dead men downtown, which is sort of a complaint many people, and we do have some great bronze dead white guys downtown, but coming here to Roxbury, there's amazing art all over our communities, and it also tells this one stories about Boston that often aren't told, that story about the effort to secede is mostly forgotten. Part of the goal of this thing was to sort of look outside of just the downtown and see what else we're missing and see the amazing things that are happening in all the different neighborhoods of Boston.
Well, that's WBUR arts reporter Greg Cook. Greg's ranked the 50 best works of public art in Boston. And joining us now are two artists on the list, Mags Harries, who did the glove cycle work in the Porter Square T-stop in Cambridge. It's number 49 on the list. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And thank you for being the force behind making that long escalator trip so delightful for so many years. Also joining us is David Fichter. He and some young people began the Mystic River mural in Somerville in 1996. And they continue to add to it every summer. It's number 33 on the list. David, welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you. Hi, Meg.
Hi, David.
Well, it's great to have you both. Let me just first start by getting your reaction to the list of 50 that WBUR has created. Mags, what do you make of it?
Well, I think it's provocative. I think it's created dialogue. I think that's absolutely fabulous. I'm unhappy to be 49th on the list, but I'm happy I made the list. So, you know, there's a mixed thing there. But, you know, it's something that we should talk about. Boston is very, very, you know, there's 500% for art programs in the country, and Boston doesn't have one.
Yeah. Now, provocative, the list you found it provocative, why?
Oh, because there were, it's a very subjective list, and certainly some things are just, you know, not what I would call art, or not with the intention of the artist. But, you know, I think that's okay.
Okay.
I think that's fine.
Well, hold that thought for a second, because I want to get David's first reactions to the 50 list. What did you think of it?
Well, I thought it was a lot of fun looking through it. Again, I'm sure if I were to make the list, I probably wouldn't necessarily have the same exact ones. I mean, a great piece that I was missing was the Harriet Tubman bronze that Fern Cunningham did, but there's a lot of wonderful things on there, and I sort of enjoyed the provocative nature of including things like the orange dinosaur, I guess it was, which I actually have never seen, but which were probably not done as originally as a work of art, more as a kind of commercial enticement, but because they're beloved, have taken on more of a sort of sense through time. They've got a patina of art about them, I think.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Greg Cook told us is that he sort of intended to provoke with this list a little bit by, and one of his goals was to sort of expand what Bostonians think of as public art. Greg told us it may not have, some of the pieces may not have began as exclusively works of art, public or not, but become landmarks and therefore meaningful to a community, which he says that in and of itself is one of the functions of public art, and he'd like to see more of that in Greater Boston. And Mags, I'm wondering what you think of that, because I do feel like, I mean, you mentioned Boston in terms of financing in comparison to other cities, that we're trying to get there, but we still have the same as much financing, and then maybe still a somewhat limited view of what public art, quote unquote, should be.
Yeah, it's been very limiting, and it's been very interesting in the last year or two how that has opened up and changed. And I think that's partly because they are temporary works, so there's not the kind of reaction that, oh my God, you know, we have to live with this. So I think, you know, the JR piece was absolutely fabulous. The murals in the Greenway are fabulous. Yeah. Janet Eckelman, it's great.
That
it's
was
great.
One of my recent favorites, absolutely. Yeah. Talk about transforming your vision of the sky. David, what kind of things would you like to see more of?
Are you talking about on the list or just in general?
In general, you know, as we sort of seek to put more art, you know, in and around Greater Boston.
You know, I agree with what Meg's saying about the limitations of funding, and not just the city, but also the state. I don't think has a percent for art, but I enjoy the work that bubbles up sort of from the bottom, and sometimes it's not so much dependent on funding or a lot of funding, but more dependent on community support or kind of the guerrilla anarchical nature of its inception. And for example, the project that I've been doing on the Mystic mural has been going on for 20 years, and it's supported by the city of Somerville. But I think part of why it is because people have supported it so much that it's sort of kind of there's a feedback loop that goes on. So I don't think it's the only thing that's affecting that's important. It's not just the funding, it's also just the communities, the vitality of the communities that support the work is what really makes the work come about and come alive.
You know, Mags, in the last couple of seconds that we have, because the time really does fly by, I mean, what do you think, you know, what's one key thing that you think the city or people should do to try and get more public art out into the streets of Greater Boston or on buildings?
Well, they can ask for it. I mean, that would be a major thing. Certainly, Baker was going to cut the arts funding, but we really have to get behind it and say, yeah, we're not a second-class city. We want the art, and we want it in the foremost in the city where we can really, be proud of it.
And experience it every day.
Yeah.
Well, Mags Harris, Cambridge artist, she created the Glove Cycle in 1984 inside the Porter Square T-stop. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure.
And I'm sure on other people's lists, you're far higher than 49. And David Fichter, a Cambridge artist as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Go to WBUR.org for that list of the 50 best works of public art in around Greater Boston. Happy Friday, everybody. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.